UK Wine Show, show number 181 for the 6th of November 2009. Alistair Mayling, Group Winemaker at Villa Maria. Hi guys, and welcome to the UK Wine Show. My name's Chris Scott, and this week we have another great show. We're talking with Alistair Mayling, Group Winemaker at Villa Maria. We find out about what a group winemaker is, how a flying winemaker flew before even walking, and the secrets behind Villa Maria's claim to being New Zealand's most awarded winery. In the spotlight, we are looking at our poll question. The government is planning on changing legislation to allow smaller sample size measures. The results were quite surprising. I also have the winner to our latest book competition for the Concise World Atlas of Wine. And wow, I've had some great comments from listeners to the show who have been entering the draw for the book. Thanks all very much for all your kind comments, and I will try and live up to your high expectations. If you do want to get the latest on what we're doing, you can subscribe to our newsletter, which has just gone out today, or in the last couple of days anyway. And also you can follow me on Twitter. My URL, I suppose, is called WineScriber, all one word. Or you can find me on Facebook under Chris Scott. I've been communicating on these channels a lot more over the last wee while, so do keep an eye out for that. But first up, let's have our mystery grape variety. If this is the first time you've listened to the show, then I'm going to give you a clue now and then another clue after the news and answer right at the very end of the show. So see if you can work out what our mystery grape variety is. We're thinking of an Italian white grape variety. The grape, which is susceptible to rot, is concentrated in the southeastern corner of Piedmont, where temperatures are high enough for the grapes to achieve their ripeness quite early on. Here, it's aromatic with white flowers, citrus fruit notes when young, but develops complexity and mineral notes and a pronounced acidity, which makes it suitable for making into sparkling wines. Have we pondered that? Because next up we have the news with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. First Quench Retailing, owners of Thresher and Wine Rack, has confirmed it's going into administration. 81 staff at the head office have been made redundant. The off-licence chain has more than 1,000 stores and employs around 6,000 people. The news follows months of speculation about the future of the business, which had been incurring heavy losses. Administrators KPMG are hoping to sell the business as a going concern and keep as many jobs as possible. With the off-licence sector facing aggressive competition from supermarkets and the recession putting more strain on the business, the future of the off-licence model is far from certain.
Cheers, Jane. I think the future of the off-licence model is okay, just not convenience off-licences such as Thresher's. The administrators think that they'll be able to sell the business in the next couple of months as a going concern, and many of the reports I've seen talk about how they made some misorders early in the year and the recession has caused the problems. I'm not sure about that, but I know that competition from the supermarkets and a revitalised independent sector on the internet are not helping. Speaking of competition from the supermarkets, what are they up to now, Jane?
Well, this week, Sainsbury's is cutting the price of all its wines and champagnes by 25%, provided you purchase a minimum of 6 bottles. Waitrose responded the day after the Sainsbury's promotion went live with a similar deal which included fortified wines. The Sainsbury's offer ends 10th of November and Waitrose on the 11th.
Be quick, this is a good opportunity to buy some interesting wines. Normally, I tell people to avoid supermarket offers as they're often a bit of a con, but an across-the-board offer like this is definitely worth looking at. Do try some more unusual wines that are not normally on offer. That's my recommendation. What's the last story, Jane?
Well, finally this week, for years, some people have believed that the mineral taste in wine came from the soils the vines were grown in. But now, according to geologist Alex Maltman, this has been found to be untrue. Speaking at the Geological Society of America's 2009 annual conference, he said that if wine lovers are going to talk about a mineral taste in wine, they should acknowledge that we don't at present know its cause. The notion that a vineyard set in slate bedrock yields wine with a slaty taste has persisted in some circles. Mineral wines, he said, used to be described as lean or austere. Others, such as biologist Jamie Good, believe that any mineral notes in wine are most likely the result of reductive winemaking, where the juice is protected from oxygen. That's it from me this week, but don't forget to check out our website, 3050.co.uk.
I must admit, I do find it hard to spot minerality in wines, and I tend to agree with Alex and Jamie. I think minerality is often used to describe acidic wines on the palate and perhaps a touch of reduction on the nose. I remember listening to loads of wine lectures going on about minerality in a tight Chablis or an austere Burgundy, and I'm pleased that the Geological Society has called the wine industry out on this. It's not minerality in the wine, and the tests show that the minerals in the soils do not get into the wines. Now, it's not necessarily a bad descriptor, as it does convey the correct impression of the wine. It's just that too many people think that the minerals come from the soils, when in most cases, it's coming from climate and winemaking. What do you think of that rant? I do get a bit uptight with terroir, as it's often quoted and completely confused and misunderstood concept. I think it's best to use more specific terms and split the components of terroir out. Otherwise, too many people think terroir is all about soils, when in fact the soils are the least important of the building blocks of wine, with climate, grape variety, and winemaker's influence all far, far, far more important. Okay, let's get off this topic before I get too wound up. So, quickly moving on. Next up, we have the Spotlight. And in this week's Spotlight, we're looking at this month's poll, which was, the government is planning to change the legislation to allow smaller sample size measures of wine. What do you think? The response to this month's poll show that even though the question was raised by wine retailers, which wanted to allow more sampling of wine, 35%, the largest group, thought it was good, as they can sample different wines throughout the meal. The second biggest group, again, was quite positive, 26% saying good, they could sample wines without having to pay for a whole glass. This gave a total of 61% in favour of smaller sample sizes. Of those who thought it was a bad thing, 23% thought it would add confusion, and 125ml is enough. The smallest group of 16% thought it was bad because retailers would charge more for their samples. It looks like the change in size could be a boom for UK foodies. A range of sizes I think probably could be quite good, with a small snifter for dessert wines, which, let's face it, after a whole meal, 125ml glass of dessert wine is a bit OTT, but a 50ml sample looks pretty good to me. So perhaps this could be a winner for the restaurants. Dessert wines and ports could be the big winners. And maybe, with a smaller sample size, more companies may want to do more wine and food matches. On the downside, it does add costs. More wines by the glass mean more work for staff and more equipment. But the likes of Suffrages and their Wonder Bar use a self-service wine jukebox, which improves flexibility and keeps the cost down because staff don't have to pour it. The smallest group, 16%, thought it was bad because retailers could charge for samples. As this was proposed by retailers looking to do just that, I thought more people would be concerned by this. But paying for samples is not a bad thing. I taste an awful lot of wines, and a lot more than I buy, that's for sure. And if I'm at a winery, I'm happy to pay a small token fee. After all, they're running a business, and they need to be profitable. I doubt if many high street retailers or the likes of Majestic would charge for their samples. After all, they're really after you selling the wines. It's just the really high-end retailers who might be showing a £200 bottle of wine that would probably want to charge for their samples. And that's fair enough. Okay, that pretty much ends the Spotlight this week. We're going to be reviewing Michael Schuster's latest edition of Essential Wine Tasting next week. And I will be giving a copy away for you guys next week as well. If you want to enter, just drop me an email at chris.scott@3050.co.uk. Don't forget to give me your physical address so I know where to send the book. And once again, this book is light enough that we can ship it anywhere in the world. So great for those who contacted me in the far recesses of the world. The winner of the last wine book, The Concise World Atlas of Wine, went to William Turner, who lives in British Columbia in Canada. So that book will be on its way to you probably in about a week's time, William. And I'm really pleased an overseas listener got a chance to win the book. We've had lots and lots of emails from people coming in from Australia, California, Canada, all over the place. So I'm really pleased it went out to somewhere from there who these people can't normally participate in any of the competitions we do. Something that's not too far away, well, Italy anyway, is our grape variety. We're going to have the next clue before our interview with Alistair. So, our second clue. Our Italian white grape variety, most recognised for making DOCG wine in Garve in Piedmont, and according to the Garve Consortium, had its first reference for the vine in 1659 and also again in 1688, in which Marchese Dora from Montalado Castle speaks about the vines in some fermenting vats. Today, the grape, which is susceptible to rot, is concentrated in the southeastern corner of Pedemont. Only in Garvey, as in Garvey to Garvey, does the wine really achieve weight and crispness. Okay, I will give you the answer to our mystery grape variety after our interview with Alistair Mayling, which is coming up next. We find out what a group winemaker is and the secrets behind Villa Maria's claim to being New Zealand's most awarded winery. Let's have a listen to what Alistair has to say. Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Alistair Mayling, the group winemaker at Villa Maria. How are you, mate?
Very well, thank you.
Excellent. You're a master of wine as well. That sounds pretty impressive. Winemaker and MW.
Yeah, exactly.
It's only what you and Sam Harrop that I know of.
The winemakers, Michael Brakovich from New Zealand, and from a winemaking point of view, that's all. Then Steve Smith from a viticultural point of view.
Craigie Range.
And there would be then Bob Campbell.
Is he a winemaker? I thought he was
No, he's not a winemaker. No, then not a winemaker, but also an MW. So you've got Bob Campbell and Margaret Harvey. That's right.
So is that Peter
McCombie.
And Peter McCombie.
Peter McCombie.
Is that a handful of New Zealanders?
Yeah, there's probably eight, I think, about eight. Yeah.
And where did you do your MW? Was it here?
In the UK.
In the UK.
Yeah, and I did it in the UK when I was with working for a company called International Wine Services.
Let's just find out a wee bit about yourself. Just did a presentation on your wines, and we'll touch on some of the wines in a minute. But you did say that you started off as almost like an international winemaker before you actually tasted wines in New Zealand.
Almost.
What's the story there?
Yeah, no, did it a little bit backwards, but always wanted to travel and was fascinated by fascinated with the wine and a little bit of work in New Zealand and thought, well, I'd love to get overseas and experience what happened overseas and see if I really did like wine and use that as an excuse to do our two-year overseas travel.
Yep.
And went to Hungary, did a vintage, loved it, came back to New Zealand, studied, and then went back to Europe and ended up what was going to be a six-week job, which then revolved into working around the world for 7 or 8 years.
Ah, very good. First flying winemaker or one of the first?
One of the early ones, exactly. That was in 94, actually. And in those days, it would have been, one of the very, very, very beginning of the Flying Winemaker type program.
Mm-hmm. And when did you first meet George Fistinich?
George, yeah, met George. That's a good question. It would have been around about 94, 95. Mm-hmm. And that was when I worked a vintage actually at Esk Valley. And
was that under Gordon?
That was under Gordon.
Yeah.
And Gordon Russell, so, yeah, nice bloke. Great guy.
The only man I know that's got louder shirts than me.
That's right. So I met George. I think I met George at the vintage party actually. At the end of vintage party in Auckland when they had a group party get together there. So that would be my first occasion of meeting George. May have met him visiting the wineries, but that was my first meeting of George. And then I went overseas and then met him on the odd occasion back in the UK when he was over for the London Wine Trade Fair. And then the next time was back working for Villa Maria.
Excellent. And did you go straight into the role as group winemaker?
I did. Yes, I did.
That's quite a good way of entering a company, isn't it?
It was. I know. I did a vintage at Esk Valley, which is part of the Villa Maria group, working in the lab. And that was straight out of university and left. And, you know, they will talk about, you know, you've got to leave the company to come back in at a higher level. And that's almost what happened. So it was perfect timing. I was working with a guy called Kim Milne, who also a flying winemaker, and he had been a previous group winemaker at Villa Maria. So there was a bit of an association there. He knew George and had actually worked at Esk myself. So it worked out, you know, I think it worked out pretty well in terms of timing and, you know, it was a good opportunity.
So as the group winemaker for New Zealand's number two winery, what does that mean? Do you actually drag hoses these days or are you more of a, okay, boy, you'll go off and do that. We're going to drain this tank and...
Yeah, no, it's unfortunately I got into the industry because I loved the sort of the hands-on side of it and getting involved with it and the role has grown and evolved and it's certainly not on the cellar floor anymore. It's much more about the bigger picture side of the winemaking. And so how we work it anyway is that I get involved in setting the wine style, how we're going to make the wine and type of oak we're going to use and involved in the viticulture in terms of identifying blocks for top end or middle end or bottom end and then
is that done through sampling or terroir?
Yeah, all of those and history in terms of quality. And then come up with the wine styles, how we're going to make the wine, what we're going to do, come vintage, leave the winemakers to have a bit of autonomy during the vintage in terms of winemaking within the winery. And I'm in the vineyard a lot, tasting the fruit, making the call when we're going to pick it. And we, you know, as the vintage unfolds, you know, you might need to tweak your styles and what you're going to do. So we're always on the phone daily. And then come post-vintage, have the blending and get back involved in all of the blending, always involved in all the blendings and what we're trying to do and what we're trying to achieve from a sales point of view. So talking to the market. So out of that, I'm covering the, you know, cross-production, cross-sales, cross-marketing, back into winemaking and trying to pull all that together to ensure that we make the best possible wine. So trying to give the guys autonomy, yet still being involved in it. So, yeah, more desk-bound than on the floor, but still into the tasting room on a daily basis, tasting wines, tasting samples, looking at putting blends together. So,
okay, one of the things that you said, I think, in your presentation earlier was that Villa Maria, or maybe George said, that Villa Maria focusing on winning awards quite early on, you know, that was one of their key strategies. And we spoke to George last week about how when the company went into receivership, they came home with a clutch of trophies, and that pretty much saved the company.
That's right.
So it sounds like a good strategy. I've heard some few people not so happy with Villa Maria say that you do make wines to win awards and you can't get hold of them very often because they're in such small quantities. Is that true or?
No, it's not true at all.
Sour grapes?
A little bit. I mean, the go to any wine show or judge in any wine show, you've got no idea what the wine is. Yes, a wine has to potentially show well on the day amongst a whole lineup. But we... You know, how can you make a wine when you don't know what the judges are going to be, who the judges are going to be, what they're going to be really looking for? You know, we've heard stories that, you know, we have a special oak brew that you add to the wine and all that type of thing, which is, you know, it doesn't happen. I mean, what we do is that we've got a absolute, you know, desire to make top quality wine, right from the vineyard all the way through to the end result. And when we talk to people that have been working at Villa Maria and go and work at other wineries, they always, or in most cases, they comment that at Villa they're fastidious, the attention to detail is immaculate, the length to go to that extra degree is what seems to set it apart versus other wineries which perhaps don't operate in that way. And I really think it comes down to having a, fortunately, having great vineyards with and a wide range of vineyards. We don't just pick a vineyard, we identify it into blocks, so therefore we've got smaller parcels to deal with, and we've just got blending options, and so therefore we can pick and choose, pick the eyes out of it. So yeah, I don't buy into that at all.
But you do have quite a strategy in terms of having an entry-level product where the fruit may not be quite as good, but it's sold at a price point. What are your ladder? Because you've got quite a sophisticated product ladder in terms of increasing quality.
Yeah, so starting at the entry level, we've got a private bin range, which is could be multi-regional, could be single varietal, could be a blend, and it's all about consistency of product, purity of fruit, low levels of oak, enjoyable. For an entry level type consumer, it's a wine that they find very drinkable, easy to understand. Quite approachable and nothing complicated about it.
Yep.
Then you move to your next tier, which is in theory that what we call the mid tier, which is cellar selection, gold label wine and gold label. And it is a wine that I think anyway always over delivers in quality for the value point that it has. And really the reason for that is that we have a top down approach where we put our single vineyard and reserve blend wines together first, and we always make a bit more of that area, and what doesn't go into that blend trickles down into the cellar selection. So that wine, I think, really does over deliver, and is a, you know, I drink it as an everyday wine because it is bloody good wine, yet it's just a little bit more approachable than what you get to at the next tier up, which is our reserve and single vineyard wines. And we used to only have single vineyard wines, but we embraced the single vineyard concept in about 2002, 2003.
They're just wines that come from a vineyard?
Correct.
And not even a block within a vineyard?
Yes.
Or a whole vineyard?
No, a block. Could be within a block within a vineyard. And these are vineyards that we've identified over a number of years that consistently are producing good wine, relatively unique flavours, learning about sub-regionalisation and saying that, yep, that characteristic from the Wairau Valley in Marlborough versus the Archery, quite distinct, pretty consistent. Yep, we should look at it as a single vineyard. And it's a concept that's worked well because retailers have been asking for something unique for their own use. At a top end, and the single vineyard works that well because we can do a single vineyard for them and they can have it as an exclusive product. So the reserve and the single vineyard wines are at the top end, quality-wise exactly the same, but just single vineyard is exactly as it means. Reserve is a blended wine from more than one vineyard.
I had a count on your website, the number of wines on your New Zealand website anyway, and I counted 38 different wines from different cellar selections through to single vineyards, your different regions that you've got. So do you always enter all the wines into the competitions or do you choose, pick and choose? Because if you've got that many different things, you've got to win something sooner or later.
That's right. Well, we enter I would probably say that our marketing spend is most heavily spent in wine shows.
entering them.
I mean, the Villa Maria statement is New Zealand's most awarded winery, and therefore, we've got to try and achieve that in some form or other. And if we don't, we have to look at ourselves. But yes, we enter a lot of wines into wine shows, and therefore, the odds are pretty good. But other wineries, large wineries, enter a similar number of wines and don't do as well. So there's a bit of a correlation in terms of wine, the attention to detail that comes into play. But we're really proud. We win gold medals with our private bin wines. And to give an example, last week our private bin Merlot won Champion Merlot Bordeaux Red at the Perth Wine Show. And that's a great example, and it's very good for that commercial wine to get a result. So it's not just the single vineyard wines that are made in small volumes and that get it. It's the lower end as well.
I want to just talk about some of the wines we tasted. We've just done a flight of 12 wines, pairing some of Villa Maria's wines to some of the European competition. And whilst I like your wines, some of the wines you put yourself up against were pretty good. I really like the Pinot as well.
You mean the Burgundy Pinot?
Yeah. I like Burgundy, but yes. It was a really nice one.
I really
like that. One of the interesting things was the Pinot Gris comparison, and some of the people discussed it. We talked about alcohol levels in the tasting and the debate.
Yeah.
And there was a couple of things that sort of said, I was curious by, obviously alcohol levels, and you talked about trying to get your alcohol levels down. Do you want to tell us what the problem with Pinot Gris or Pinot Grigio is with regards to alcohol levels?
Pinot Gris as a wine style, or certainly as a variety in New Zealand, you need to hang it a long time on the vine to get the flavour. The flavours seem to come late in this variety. And the correlation of that is that you end up with high alcohol as well, or potential alcohol. So the challenge for the industry is trying to get flavour but pick at an earlier level. And what I mentioned in the talk that I did was that I think vine age has got a huge part to play in it, in that sort of, certainly when you compare it to ourselves, for example, where you've got some older vines that, and you're getting, good alcohol balance in there. So you think, to me, I think there's a correlation that comes into play there. And I'm also, so therefore I'm hoping that over time, we're going to get vines in balance that are going to be producing, allow us to ripen fruit at an earlier stage and therefore get that in balance. But I also think that as a winemaking team, we're, learning about Pinot Gris every year. And I think that probably there is a factor that what I'm seeing anyway is that the flavours potentially are already in the Pinot Gris, but we're actually not tasting them on the vine.
So this is
quite subtle.
Yeah, this is what threw me, because I've spoken to a few people, and whilst I accept, and people have had a few scientists agree that things like Sauvignon Blanc, you taste Sauvignon Blanc, the saliva changes the flavour, so you do get the flavour in the mouth. Most grapes, you can't taste the flavours. Mm. So I was a bit surprised for you to say you can taste Pinot Gris flavours, because normally when you put a grape into your mouth, you get the precursors, but it's the fermentation that converts the precursor into the final flavour. But you seem to think that you weren't getting them. But once the wine had been fermented, you were getting the flavour. So I sit there going, that's consistent with what I hear, but I was surprised that you think you can taste the flavour.
We think we can taste flavours in the grapes, characteristics, or however you want to describe them as being. But I think under Pinot Gris, they're probably bound or tied in under the skins, more so than other varieties. And therefore, we think, no, they're not there yet. We need to leave them for another few days or 5 days or whatever it may be. And we hang it out. But the reality is that once we've got it into fermentation and crushed the grapes, the flavours are released and they're there, as you mentioned.
Is it a crushing or a fermentation?
Well, I think it's probably a combination of both. And, you know, we're always sort of surprised tasting the juice or tasting the early ferment wines or even the juice. No, it's definitely the crushing is a big part of it, because you taste the juice and these have got more flavour.
Is it a pear flavour that's coming through?
Yeah, definitely pear. Definitely pear. And which makes me think that perhaps we need to revisit that. And this year, 2009 vintage, we picked a bit more on when we felt we needed to pick from an alcohol point of view than waiting for the flavour. And so we've got a lower alcohol wine, which, tasting the wine, it's got just as much flavour and intensity. So I think there's probably something in that at this stage anyway.
Let's have a look at some of the other wines. You did a Sancerre comparison, and it was interesting talking to some of the guys at the table. We got into a big debate about reductive flavours versus to give you minerality, which I'm a big believer that minerality is a reductive note rather than a terroir note.
But sure.
Everybody's got their own opinion, particularly
that's
if you're
right.
French. So the Sauvignon Blanc for me was an easy winner. I liked yours a mile ahead of Sancerre.
Yeah, it was a very dry style, wasn't it?
Yeah. The Riesling, that was an easy one to spot as well, because you had a nice German Riesling, which I think my notes were very good, gorgeous, loved it. And your one was okay.
Yeah.
Which is a bit sad, but it was a very good German wine. But the acidity in your wine really surprised me, or the sugar level, because you said it was about 27 grams of sugar.
Right.
I picked it at about 10, how many grams did I say? I think I picked 8 to 10 grams.
That's right.
And when you said 27 grams, I was, wow, that's really sweet, but you don't notice it in the wine. What's driving the Riesling like that?
It's clearly the acidity, and it's all about balance. So New Zealand is blessed by natural acidity, and it's one real USP in terms of what it can offer across all varieties, and Riesling is no exception to that. So we can make these wines with a bit of residual sugar. 27 grams sounds a lot, but when you've got a low pH and a relatively high acid in the wine, or acidity in the wine, the balance is the wines seem much drier than what they really are. Now, when they're young, they do show a little bit of, they're disjointed, so there is a bit of a RS acid finish to them, but over a bit of time that comes together and gels, and it really does work well. Young vine, the Riesling, the New Zealand Rieslings are still very young and still very tight. We tried against a Dom Hof from the NAR, which looks superb and has got huge ageability to it.
It was
so
nice.
But I do think that style, 10% alcohol, some residual sugar, good natural acid is a style that New Zealand can do.
The other one that was quite interesting was the Syrah. And I did ask a question about the pepperiness in it, because there is bags of pepper in there. And I've seen lots and lots of pepper in New Zealand Syrahs. Yep. And it is a hallmark of it. And I did get shouted down by the likes of Oz Clark saying, oh, no, keep the pepper in there. But
yeah,
I've tasted New Zealand Syrah with bags of pepperiness with a lot of UK consumers now, hundreds of them.
Yep.
And as a general rule, they don't like it. They find it too peppery and not fruity enough, and almost green. Pepperiness is almost like a green note in the wine. I always associate pepperiness as being quite a cool climate, Syrah.
Yeah.
Do you think that ripeness will improve with time, or are you really picking to highlight the pepperiness?
The reality is, I think it's just a natural characteristic that comes into New Zealand Syrah. And if you were to perhaps leave it on the vine for longer, you may lose some of that. There could be a factor that, you know, you get a lot of shrivel in Syrah, and that, you know, maybe
grapes shrivel up.
Yeah, they do. And maybe that is actually concentrating the pepperiness. I haven't really given that real thought to it. You know, we see that, you know, it's either white or black pepper. There's no doubt about it. And I think the white pepper is a cooler style characteristic versus the black pepper. And what we call black pepper, come to the UK and many people say, oh, that's white pepper. So it's like, okay, you know, if that's the way you interpret it. It's, I think the danger is trying to go burn it all off, and you end up trying to end up with a sort of like an Australian Shiraz, which is not typical at all, and you sort of completely bastardize what you're trying to achieve. But
there's like a difference between, well, for me anyway, there's a difference between a complexing element,
yeah, yes,
and a fundamental big block of the flavor. Pepper seems to be one of the big blocks,
yeah,
of flavor profiles. Mm, mm. And I don't put loads of pepper on my food, so I don't, yeah, know if I want to drink my wine, yeah, with loads of pepper.
Yeah,
in it.
I really wonder whether it's, and I don't have an answer to it, you know, is it just something that's because of the climate that we have? Is it the location of where the vines are? I'd say probably that's not a factor, because New Zealand Syrah has that characteristic, whether it's in the Waiheke or Hawke's Bay or wherever it may be.
I've had high pepper Syrahs out of Yarra Valley in Australia as,
yeah,
well, which is relatively cool.
Yeah, so I think it's probably a maritime sort of environment, and, you know, we aren't hot, really. I mean, as you say, we're maritime. The Gimlet Gravel area where we grow most of our Syrah is warmer than other regions, but it's not hot. And so it probably comes down to that reasoning. And, you know, if you compare that to the Rhone is, you know, it has a warmer night and a warm day. We have a cooler night and a warm day. So there could be some diurnal factors that kick in, and that's probably, you know, your cooler nights that just sort of hold back the, I suppose, the, you know, so the leafy herbal sort of notes, which are characterized as white pepper or black pepper, and maybe bring them to the fore.
I've noticed, yeah, if you let the wine breathe, the pepperiness, yeah, drops away,
yes,
quite quickly.
Yeah.
So if you want to, whenever, yeah, I want to highlight it,
yeah,
I pull the cork and then pour it. And if I, yeah, let it breathe for an hour, it
moved
fades.
On.
Yeah, yeah, it fades very quickly. Mm, so, mm. Interesting stuff. Interesting stuff.
Good.
Just one last question before we wrap up is Screwcaps. Villa Maria moved to Screwcaps, what, about the same time you joined? And
that's
what,
right.
What was it, about
2002.
How's that going? And you export to the US market. US isn't known to understand Screwcaps, and they're quite opposed, yeah, to it from, yes, talking to people I know. How's that affected you guys?
Well, the first year that we did do it, which was in sort of 2003, we met huge resistance in the US, and we got delisted from probably 80% of the restaurant chains that had our Sauvignon Blancs or wines in there, and that was obviously a worry. But within 12 months, I think we had regained listings in probably 80% of those restaurants. So once they realized, once they understood and saw that it wasn't just Villa Maria, but the rest of New Zealand were following that suit, they did see it. And I mean, you're always going to get people that are completely opposed to Screwcap, but from a consistency of quality, you can't really go past it. And in my, you know, I have an open mind about closures, in that, you know, if something new comes along, we need to review it and consider it. And if that supersedes Screwcap, then you've got to embrace it. But at the moment, I think that Screwcap offers a very good solution for what we're trying to achieve.
What about evolution in the bottle?
Mm-hmm.
The reason I'm asking is I've had quite a lot of Otago Pinots and Screwcaps,
yes,
and they, yep, don't seem to evolve. And I had a 2001 Chard Farm, which was the last year they'd put it into cork, yep, on the weekend.
Yes.
And it was evolving beautifully. I was, yep, like, wow. I tasted, yep, it. I hadn't really noticed whether it was a Screwcap or a cork. You know, I think, yep, my wife opened it.
Yes.
And I went, wow, this is brilliant. And,
yep,
then I looked and I went, oh, no Screwcap. almost could tell.
Have you had a look at older wines and seen how's the evolution changed?
Yeah, well, the evolution does evolve, but definitely at a slower rate compared to wine under cork. And so, you know, it retains those primary fruits for longer. It retains, you know, a bit more acidity. It's tighter. It's less evolved, obviously.
Do you get good tertiary aromas coming
through?
But
you do. You get some good aromas coming through, and, you know, you have to put them away for a bit longer. And
was it 10%, 20%?
Yep, probably. I think it probably there's not much difference from a red wine point of view over the first couple of years. There's not a lot of difference. And then suddenly the Pinot Noir a red wine under cork accelerates quite quickly versus the wine under screw cap just goes along at a very measured rate. So the gap widens quite quickly under a red wine point of view. As I said, the oldest wine we've got is, you know, 2001, something like that, 2000. So not a lot of age in terms of where it's at. But if you put the two together, basically what you're seeing is two really good wines at completely different stages of their life.
So where would be the screw cap? You know, if you had 2001 all the way through to 2008, where would the 2001 screw cap be? What would it be closest to in terms of a cork?
Probably, you know, a wine that was 2 years younger.
2 years younger.
Yeah, something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, Alistair, I'll let you get away.
Thank you.
A few glasses of wine to be drunk and a few coffees to be had. Thank you very much for your time, mate.
No problem, Chris. Thank you.
Cheers, bud.
Okay.
As it was clear from the interview, I spoke with Alistair after a tasting of his wines compared to some of the very top-end European wines, which was very, very nice of him to do because I quite liked some of the wines. And awfully brave of Alistair to put his 10 to 20 pound bottles up against the top European wines at 20 to 100 pounds, but they held up pretty well against the onslaught. Next week, we're going to be getting all geeky, and we're talking to an old friend of the podcast, Jamie Good. He's a plant biologist and a wine blogger, and we talked to him about vine plant biology. One thing that a bit of knowledge about plant biology won't help you with is this week's grape variety. How'd you get on with it? It was a tricky one, but the Gavi to Gavi reference should have helped some of you guys. It is, of course, Cortez. Let's have those clues again. Cortez is an Italian white grape variety most recognized for making DOCG wines in Gavi in Piedmont. According to the Gavi Consortium, the first reference to Cortez vine growing was in written letters by the estate manager of Monteledo Castle to the Marquess of Dora in 1659 and in 1688. Which he refers to the vines that are all Cortez, some fermenting in vats, and a sweet Nebbiolo, which is that black grape variety which you don't normally hear about too much as a sweet red wine. Today, the grapes, which is susceptible to rot, is concentrated in the southeastern corner of Piedmont, where temperatures are high enough for the grapes to achieve their quite early ripeness. Only in Gavi, as in Gavi di Gavi, does the wine really achieve weight and crispness. Here, it is with aromatic white flowers, citrus fruit notes while young, but develops complexity with mineral notes and a pronounced acidity as it ages. The Cortez grape, because of its high acidity, is also suitable for making sparkling wines. Okay, that pretty much ends the show. Just one more thing now is the quote. And this week it was mailed in by Mike Holden when he entered the competition. Sorry, mate, you didn't win, but the quote was pretty good. It's apparently a German proverb. Wine contains wisdom. Beer contains strength. Water contains bacteria. I'm not sure how old it is, given that bacteria wasn't fully understood until Louis Pasteur, but it's a good one anyway. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.